Friday, February 13th, was a full, good White House day. I was up at 8 and started to the pool. I asked Lyndon to come with me. To my delight, he did. We talked and swam. This time, I probably only got 20 turns instead of my usual 30. But I gave myself extra marks for getting Lyndon in the pool. He has been so wonderful about staying on this diet. Zephyr plans the menu. Juanita figures the calories. And they juggle the menu if necessary. They put the card by his plate, and he sticks to it. The little chart in the bathroom by the scales goes down and down. He's about 201 now. Such a wonderful difference. But he does not get the exercise to which he was so vigorously faithful while we were home Christmas. Then Jean-Louis came for a hairdo, and under the dryer I talked to Liz about my April trip to Texas. And then the first real appointment of the day was Adele Simpson, Miss Trez and Patsy. He is a man, in spite of the name. In this life, there are at least 2 days, maybe more, in about February and about August, that are devoted entirely to clothes. Today was a partial one. And there are at least 2 women from the world of fashion that I've come to think of as my very special friends, Adele Simpson and Molly Parnes. A quick look through her spring showing, one selection, several maybes, and then we had to postpone the rest till tomorrow, because since I had planned to see her, something had been set that I must be a part of. The ceremony in the East Room for the National Medal of Science Awards went down a little after 12:30, waited for Lyndon at the elevator, and we marched past the Marine Band and a battery of cameras into the East Room for another of these ceremonies. So many of them, and this is one, that give a lift to the heart. This is Dr. Donald Hornig's show. He is the assistant to the president for science and technology. The National Medal of Science was established by an act of Congress in 1959 to provide recognition for individuals who make outstanding contributions in the physical, biological, mathematical, and engineering sciences. And today, the 12 receive them for contributions so sophisticated and specialized that I could hardly pronounce, much less understand them. But there were some familiar names to me. Edwin Land, who had produced the Polaroid camera, and I had watched him receive the Medal of Honor here. And Igor Sikorsky, a pioneer in aircraft, who looked like a very distinguished old gnome. And his product, the helicopter, has played a very important part in our lives. And Kistiakovsky, who had been, I believe, a science advisor to President Eisenhower, and later was, I believe, one of the scientists and engineers for Johnson in 64. Lyndon's speech was a great one. I only wish he had had more time to study it and had delivered it with more passion, because I knew the passion was there in his feeling that knowledge could free us from our problems and that these men were contributing to knowledge. And after the last medal had been handed out, the beaming Dr. Hornig behind the podium and Lyndon congratulating the recipient, he then went in the blue room. Lyndon had his picture made with the 12 recipients, and then began the receiving line. There was Bill Hagerty. He's the sort of man you want to greet by throwing your arms around him. And he was just as full of enthusiasm as ever. The nicest thing about the ceremony is that the families of the recipients come in full measure. Wives bedecked with orchids, children of all ages in their party best. There was one adorable little girl who looked like she ought to have her portrait painted in a velvet dress with a lace collar. A small group of congressmen who were particularly oriented toward science, or whose constituents had been winners, even including Speaker McCormick and Mel Laird. A sizable representation from space, Dr. Glenn Seaborg, Jim Webb himself, Ed Welch, and the scientists who had been on the President's Committee to award the National Medal of Science. It was, in its highly specialized way, a very star-studded group. And I tried to add to the atmosphere of, this is a special moment, a brilliant moment, because you have done something great, by expressing all the warmth and applause I could. This job ought really to be filled by an actress. There are moments when one needs to be. Lyndon was in a desperate hurry for an imperative luncheon to which he was late. The receiving line had to go too fast, so when it was over, I went into the state dining room where they were passing sherry and tomato juice and little salty things, and went from group to group, visiting and congratulating and feeling duly rewarded because the families seemed thrilled and happy to be in the White House and that one of their own had received the medal. Then upstairs, where I had lunch on a tray, Linda came in to visit. And at 2 o'clock began the most important meeting of the day, my sitting with Madame Shumatov. Clark Clifford had already seen the portrait, and he had been almost ecstatic. Madame Shumatov was ready in the Lincoln sitting room. The light is good there. I did not want to look. I gave it the briefest glance, and then sat down in a chair where I could not see it. Linda Bird came in and examined it very critically, and with a sort of approval that made me relax and settle into my chair comfortably. Maybe within the next 2 months, I will have a portrait for the White House. Not the important one, that is Lyndon's, but that step may follow. Madame Shumatov talked easily and interestingly, quite a steady stream, really, and I find myself relaxing into the chair. It is as though two separate talents were involved, the painter's talent of the eye and the hand, and the talent of the raconteur. It keeps the sitter interested and at ease, and both go along in tandem. The sitting lasted more than 2 hours for the 10-minute break, and then we made a date to meet again, and feeling encouraged, almost elated, I said goodbye, did some more work in my room, tried to take a 30-minute nap. These 6 or 7 hour long nights, when Lyndon turns the light off at 1 or 2 and wakes up again at 7, leave me dull and depleted. How can he stand it? And at 5 o'clock, I dressed and joined Juanita, Dorothy Dorito, and Dr. Grover, and went over to the Smithsonian. The public day was over. Dylan Ripley met us at the car, and I saw for the first time their great modern steel sculpture. It was good. The first such piece I ever really liked, and it's because it's well married to the building it is sited in. How I hope the Hirshhorn Library will be as well done. Dylan had asked 3 of his assistants, his top people, plus Mrs. Clapthor, who is the curator of the First Ladies Gallery, to go with us. This we saw first. It's 14-foot ceilings we will never be able to duplicate in the Johnson Library. That is, unless we steal a bit of the Great Hall. I explained that we hope to use a few square feet of the Johnson Library to make a vignette, a little picture of social life in the White House. Perhaps a state dinner, or Lucy's wedding reception, Linda's wedding in the East Room. We walked through about 4 galleries after the First Ladies, then the collection, campaign material, beginning with a banner used in Thomas Jefferson's campaign, right on down through a great big Kennedy button, with its papier-mâché figures in a torchlight parade and its rear platform of a train. I thought it was funny, gay, history true, and so amusingly told. Ralph Becker has a collection of campaign memorabilia which he might lend to the Johnson Library. He and Juanita have had conversations on the subject, and also he and Mary Lasker, I think. This in the Smithsonian is partly his on loan. We saw many interesting things. The electric outlets actually seemed to be just a grid below the marble floor, the possibility of plugging in about every 16 feet in a vast checkerboard. Dylan kept on saying, "Variety, variety." A small vitrine full of objects, and then a room setting, and then posters. But there were no movies, either big or little. I was charmed by it, and if the Johnson Library should emerge 50% as good, I think I would be happy. We spent an hour and a half in all, going at last to a room called Pastimes of Presidents. A combination of photos and objects. Theodore Roosevelt's rifle and skis, Lyndon's saddle. Then, when we emerged from the Smithsonian, there, sailing high in the sky above the modern sculpture, was a full moon. And Juanita said, "That accounts for all the loony letters we've been getting. It happens over and over." We thanked them all and drove back to the White House, and Juanita had what may turn out to be an excellent idea. She said, "Under the stacks, why can't we just steal a few feet and extend the ceiling on up from the 8 or 10 that it now is to at least 14. I think we should at least pursue it." Back in the White House, I got Paul Fisher to start Gone with the Wind again, second half, and Mary and I watched for about 30 minutes. Then came a call that Lyndon was coming with a friend of mine. Turned out to be C.R. Smith. He came in walking jauntily with that air of achievement that I'm happily familiar with, and he said, "Meet your new Secretary of Commerce." And that crusty gentleman himself had a very warm smile on. I congratulated Lyndon and told C.R. how happy I was that he was going to join the cabinet, and we had dinner, joined by Mary and Sam Houston and Marie. I thanked CR for the brochure he had sent me on design for electric transmission lines. All the electric companies, it seemed, had commissioned Henry Dreyfuss to draw up some handsome designs that might take the heat off of them, the public clamor to go underground with transmission lines. I remember how I'd often said that the most impressive things about New York were its bridges, those slender, graceful silver threads across the river. And so perhaps it's not impossible to get some grace, some interest in these transmission lines as they stride across the continent. At least it's an interesting climate when the industry starts trying. The talk at dinner was mostly about getting tourism to the United States. And then CR had to leave to catch a plane. And Mary and I went right back down to the theater. And for another hour and 20 minutes, suffered through the Civil War and the love story of Scarlet and Rhett. And then back upstairs, I had some exercises and a massage and went to bed a little before 12. Actually, I guess the most interesting event of the day was one that I had not participated in at all. When I returned from the Smithsonian, the second floor hall was full of activity and waiters and noise coming from the yellow room. Lyndon sent for me, and as I got to the door, he said, "And here's the youngest one of them all, introducing me to a room full of people, mostly quite young," I thought. I saw hardly any familiar faces. John Steele of Time, and Tom Johnson, I think. I simply said hello and left. I realized this must be the Time group. I had heard Lyndon's planning it. In a brief, hurried sentence, interspersing it between night reading, giving out directions to one of the young men in the morning, Time Inc. had sponsored a gathering of the presidents of university student bodies, and I think a few college editors thrown in. They were meeting in Washington to be briefed by various officials, and Lyndon had promised to meet with them. His directions to Bill or Marvin or whoever it was went something like this. You ought to get the White House fellas over to see them. You ought to ask all the young staff, and he rattled them off. Come in and visit with first one and then another, and then after they've had about 30 minutes or an hour of that, I'll come in and talk to them, and they can ask questions. I want them to see some of the young folks that help run this place. Later, I heard reports that indicated it had been an exciting, productive, wonderful meeting. I wish I could have